I always like to start with getting names, place of birth, and date of birth.
Hey, I'm Alma Conrad Sherwood Sanderson, and I was born at Somerville. My dad delivered me on a November day in 1921. The doctor was to come with his horse and buggy, and he couldn't get there in time, so there was nothing to do.
How much of the rest of your life have you lived in Union County?
I have lived in Union County all except a couple of years in Umatilla County. Mm-hmm. I guess about a year and a half in Umatilla County. Mm-hmm. And the rest of the time I have lived here in Union County. Mm-hmm. Not always out at Somerville. I lived out on the Foothill Road, south of LeGrand for 34 years. Raised a family there, and my husband had been born at that place, and he died at that place in 1984. The rest of the time, other than after Sandy and I got together, I was in Washington for 3 years, and then we moved back here.
Good. That's fine. No, same from you?
Somewhat similar to me. I'll be a little longer, perhaps, if that's all right with you.
No, go ahead. I brought plenty of tape.
Oh, okay. Well, again, I was born north of Somerville.
Give you your old name, please.
And my name is Lyle Gale Sanderson.
Is that G-A-Y-L-E?
No, G-A-I-L. And like Alma, those were the days when you called for a doctor, but the chances of him getting there were quite slight. My dad had his team hooked up to go work in the field, and Mom called out to him and says, "I think he's coming," or "It's coming." So he unhooked the horses and left the harness on and jumped on the saddle horse and headed off for Elgin, which is about 7 miles from our home place, which incidentally is known as the Sanderson Springs Farm. By the time he got to Elgin to look up for Dr. Kirby, who at that time was out somewhere else with his buggy and horse, and by the time my dad found him and got him turned around and back home, which was late in the afternoon, I'd been there quite a while. My mother had gotten a hold of her mother, which lived about a quarter of a mile away, and so she made delivery, as she had done many times, and by the time I got back, I'd been squalling for hours, and Elma here says that I'm still squalling. But anyway,
and what year was that?
That was in July 26, 1915. Mm-hmm. And the grandmother, it might be interesting to know, was my grandmother. And she, my mother, was born and raised a quarter of a mile east from our home. And my grandmother was raised as a very small child a quarter of a mile east of their place. I'll back up a little. She married a John Niederer, another Swiss gentleman, and grandma that delivered me was a small child when she came to the valley with the Hug family in the early 1870s. So consequently, she was born in the early 1870s, a quarter of a mile from the home that became the John Niederer home, which was a quarter of a mile from where I was born and raised. So that gives us sort of a continuity.
Yes.
Period of time.
Thank you. search your memories for every descriptive detail you can think of what that in that part of the valley looked like in those days when you were young?
Well, Somerville, when I was young, had my uncle owned a grocery store there. And I don't know if he built this particular one, but the building that is the Rebecca Hall, Rebecca Martell's Hall now, he had a store in the bottom part of it, and they lived in the back part. And I don't remember if, I think that the Rebeccas met upstairs at that time in Hartfield. But later he had a larger store, which had burned down, and there was that store. And at one time was a doctor's office, which my dad's sister's husband built. This is going back in and getting families all tangled up. And later belonged to my grandmother and my mother, and we lived there. You could stand in the front room and look clear through and go out the back, clear out the back door. It was just one room right after another, which is typical doctor's offices. There was another big building that some people lived in next to that one. And on the other side of that was a harness shop, which was Fred Hamilton's harness shop. The other side of the harness shop was a barber shop, and Lot Elmer was the barber.
L-O-T-T?
L-O-T-T.
Uh-huh.
The post office was in my uncle's store, and later, mother, after Uncle John died, then mother had it in her house, which was next to the store there. The store, after Uncle John passed away, was sold to Juby Brothers, and I think it was during that time that it burned down, and I can't remember for sure. Just trying to
was that a general merchandise store?
No, just mostly groceries and gasoline.
Didn't sell clothing or tools or anything like that?
Not to my knowledge.
Were you in the store when it was operating?
Oh, yes, many times.
How would you describe the way things were laid out and how business was conducted?
Well, for this, a big one-room store, when you walked in, on the left was kind of a, I wouldn't say soda fountain, because they didn't make sodas or anything there, but they did have ice cream and soft drinks and that.
With stools where you could sit and eat?
I don't remember if it did or not. This is going back way back.
Yes, that's what I intend.
They did have a big stove beyond that, where in the wintertime all the men in Somerville would come and pass away the time and shoot the breeze. And then they had a place in the back where they cooked their, and for a long time, cooked their meals, because their home was away from the store. I know Aunt Pearl, one day I went back there and I said, oh, gee, those pork chops look good. And she says, come on and have one. And I took one bite and I said, that's not pork, that's lamb. And that was the end of that. But
when I was a child, when you went into a grocery store, you just brought your list. And then you told the attendant what you wanted, and he would reach things off the shelf and put them down.
Okay.
Is that the way they did?
That's the way
they did. And
too.
Were some things piled high, so he had to use an extender device with
I don't remember
no?
that. They had shelves all along the wall.
Mm-hmm. And then, in order to figure out how much you owed, would he take a pencil and write them right on the bag?
Yeah.
and then add it up in his head?
Well, just add it up. Mm-hmm. I don't remember. I doubt that he had an adding machine.
No,
like
probably
that.
Not.
Probably in his pad. Mm-hmm. Pad that they have.
So it took quite a while to shop, didn't it?
Uh-huh. It sure did. And he had an awful good candy counter, penny candy.
Uh-huh.
And you could sometimes get two things for a penny, which is long gone.
Would people tend to come there and not only shop, but stand around and have conversation?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was...
Was it an important social center then?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you say you were in it as a child.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Why would you go in? Just to buy penny candy?
No, candy, and then we lived right next door, so I'd spend a lot of time in there.
Do you remember anything about what was discussed in those conversations?
No. No, because that was probably... a kid, I didn't pay any attention to it. Other than one day a man came in and he said he was looking for a derrick driver. My mother hadn't been in the store yet. And she said, well, I have one right here. And it was Louis Stanley, and he couldn't believe that a girl would drive derrick, but I had driven derrick every summer for some people. So he said, okay, we'll try her. So I got the job of driving derrick.
Right. Now, you told me you drove a derrick. I need to know more about that. How do you do that? What's involved?
Well, this particular job and the one with Mr. McDonald that I had was they were putting hay in the barn, and they'd use a big Jackson fork and get a big load of the hay. The horse was on the other side of the barn, and they had a big pulley on the track that this fork was on, and then the horse would go out. We'd hook a cable onto the single tree. The horse would go out, and this would pull the hay fork in. So when it got where the stacker wanted it, he'd yell, trip it, and the fellow that was doing the forking off would pull a rope, and it would trip it, and there would go the deal. Well, you done hook the derrick horse and go back, and they'd pull the fork back, and the cable would go back. So you take your horse back and hook her up again. And
why was it called a derrick?
Well, a derrick is what am I trying to say?
A derrick is built to make a hay stack
out in the open, and it's built of timbers. And there's this hay fork is attached to it too, but it goes back. You can't see my hands.
Most
of the time a team is on a derrick, a team and a cart.
Can I make a point that every farmer would have a hay barn, and this hay barn would hold 20, 30, 40, 50 tons of hay, and this same process would be that you pull up under the what's called the hay mow, and the fork would pick the hay up from the load of hay, go up and hit from a cable coming, go running out of the hay wagon into the mow on a cable, and the derrick driver would be at the back of the barn. And
well, that's the barn. This isn't the derrick.
No.
The derrick has a big arm that would swing, and so that they could get it where they wanted this big drop of hay. And usually they were pretty good sized loads on the fork, and it usually took a team and a cart, and you just drive out and back up. All you had to do is sit there. The horses had done it so much of the time that they just automatically did, and they'd wait for them to holler, and they'd start backing up. It was interesting. I hired out for Gilbert Dillard Choate, so I was going to help Mrs. Choate with cooking. And about 2 hours after we started, Dillard came in and he says, "I need a derrick grabber, kid, get out there." So he was the boss, so what I did.
What exactly did you have to do to drive?
I just sit on this cart and tell the horses to go.
You'd get signals from the men who were doing the...
Yeah, you're right there with them.
Were you in effect then controlling the horse?
More or less. And like I say, the horses usually knew more than what the kid did because they had done it so much. But once in a while, you'd have to hang on to them or get them to stop and come back.
Was there anything enjoyable about that job?
Oh, yeah. It was just fun being out with the horses, and I like horses. And it was just fun.
What did you say that the fork was called?
Jackson Fork.
And what, do you know why it was called that?
No, I don't, but that was their maker or something.
I think I've read that that was a pretty dangerous piece of equipment.
It is. I have one at home. It has tines on it about 30 inches, and there's probably about 5 or 6 of these big tines on them.
Sharp.
And they're sharp.
And it swings around, and you better watch out.
You bet.
Can I get a picture of the one you have?
At some time, I can't give to you.
No, no, no. No, I would like to go out and take a picture of it if we could arrange that. Mm-hmm. I've seen pictures, but I've never seen one in actual...
Oh, really?
...piece of equipment. Hmm. I don't suppose there are many left now.
I doubt very much.
Right.
I know one at one time when I was working for Roy Stanley, the horse and I was going out. I was leading the horse at that time, and she jerked, and the Jackson fork, before it went into the cupola and into the barn, it had turned and twisted the cable. So when it got up there, it just stopped, and it just jerked both of us off the feet almost. Then we backed up just a little bit and got it straightened around, and then it went in all right.
Would have been easy to be killed by that, I suppose, if it weren't operated correctly?
Well, probably. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think I don't remember hearing of anybody being injured or killed that way, but then they probably watched it pretty close.
Mm-hmm. Now, Lyle, when I asked her to try to search your memory to describe the area around Somerville, she started describing the buildings, which was good. Do you remember other aspects of Somerville in those days when you were quite young?
Two important things come to my mind when I was quite small, but neither of them have to do with Somerville itself. But I think historically they would be interesting.
Okay.
I'll separate. The first one has to do when I was about 4 years old, which would put me to about 1917, wouldn't it?
I thought you said
15.
1919.
About 4 years old.
1919.
Time of the First World War.
Yeah, before that. My dad and mom bought a new Model T Ford from Eugene Hug, who has a lot of historical significance. So in 1919, my mom and dad rented out the farm, and we got in that Model T Ford to try to better our lives by going to a dairy farm up in north of Victoria, British Columbia, in this Model T. Now, when we left home, everything that we had of much value to transport was packed into this Model T Ford. We started out from our home, went to La Grande, and then started across what we have always known as the Blue Mountains, heading for Pendleton. We started probably early in the morning. But when we got to out of La Grande, of course, by then we started traveling, as I still remember to this day, by watching for trees that were painted with a red circle and a white circle and a blue circle. Those trees would tell us that we were on the right road, because frequently there'd be other paths for wagons or whatever. And so my brother and I'd run ahead to look for these trees that would have these markings so that we were going in the right direction.
And this was a dirt road, of course.
And not much of a road.
Rutted?
Rutted, exactly.
Was it a rainy time? Was it muddy too?
At this particular time, no. Okay. No, as I remember... And we went as far as just somewhere in the area of the town of Meacham, which was a long day that day. And the weather must have been good, because we did all right on that. But the thing that I remember mostly is, with a Model T Ford, you wouldn't always go up a hill forward. You'd have to back up, because your gasoline would only gravity flow. So we had periods where we had to do that.
Were you carrying extra gasoline?
No.
There weren't any gas stations.
No, there were no gasoline. No, then there wasn't a... I don't remember that we had room for gasoline. But how we got it, I don't remember. And there was one place where we had a block and tackle that my dad would use. My brother, who was 6 years older than I was, I would give him quite a little bit of physical help for my dad. But they have used the block and tackle to pull up what was one hill was called Dead Man's Pass.
Mm-hmm. But they had done that with the covered wagons, hadn't they?
Yes.
Either the block and tackle or some extra means for propelling these vehicles.
I won't go any further than that at this time, because that's another story that might be helpful later.
But and you still remember that quite vividly?
I remember that very, very well, because we would run ahead. Here it is. Or my brother, usually he'd be the first one to see it then. So a lot of that was walking for us kids.
And when you said to improve your lives, was the idea to find a better place to live?
Yes, and that's another long story, because it proved quite fruitless.
Well, let's say, what was wrong with Somerville as a place to live?
We were doing pretty good. My dad had, and this is another story in itself, and I don't know if you want to talk about it now or not. But
if it helps us to understand what living there in those days was like, yes.
All right, well, we'll do that. You see, my mother and my dad married about 2 years before my oldest brother was born. My dad lived about a half mile from where my mother was born and raised. My dad came there as a man, probably in his middle teens, and he started building a house and barn and whatever we needed as best he could.
From Scotland, or was he born in this country?
No, he was born in Canada. His mother and dad both came from Scotland, and they followed the wheat harvest from Canada. They had just gotten married. They had met in what we may think of as London, Canada, which is near the Great Lakes area. And so after they got married, they followed the wheat harvest to make enough money to travel. And they traveled across, and they spent one winter after harvesting in Montana living there, and then traveled on west. And I don't have the exact story of what prompted them to come to the Grand Round Valley, but they did move to the Grand Round Valley. And my dad at that time was a kid of 7 or 8 years old, and so they settled.
This had been about 1880?
No, this was closer to, this would have been after the turn of the century, probably 1900.
Mm-hmm.
And they settled over on a place out of Flora on the breaks of the Grand Round River.
Mm-hmm.
Out of Flora. And they settled there so that my granddad could go across the Grand Round River the next year to harvest or help plant and grow the wheat over in that part of the country. Mm-hmm. So here he was, and shortly after they got there, my dad's younger sister, Bessie, who later became Bessie Oliver, she was born there. And they lived in a little cabin, dirt floor, and the very basics of things to have. And here, when he went over to get some work in the next spring, one morning my grandmother Sanderson was tending to what would normally be doing in the morning for my dad and this little baby, and she happened to come in, and here was a rattlesnake on the dirt floor curled up close to where my Aunt Bessie, which was a baby, it was in a crib. So when Grandpa Satterson came back from what he set out to do, Grandma Sanderson said, "We're moving." So they then moved to La Grande, and later then moved out to Somerville and to the old Sanderson place, which is close to where I was born and raised. But then as they, my mom and dad had us two children then. I was around 5'4". The virgin of my brother would have been about 10. It just thought, oh, we can do better. And they had pictures of going to work for this dairy.
Mm-hmm.
It was some type of relative of ours that had this up there.
Did do better,
and it didn't
mean
work out. It didn't work out.
Did do better to them mean anything other than having more money?
Basically, we had no money in those days. For many, many years, we traded this, traded beef or pork that we had butchered with other people. And as we worked for people, we traded manpower for manpower.
Mm-hmm.
Traded, when we butchered, we'd give other people the pork or the beef, and vice versa. And that was pretty much the way we lived a lot till I got up in high school.
I suspect, though, that at that time you might occasionally see a Montgomery Ward catalog, or you might see a Watkins products man come by.
We sure did.
Now, they wanted money, didn't they? Did you want what they had to sell?
Oh, we dream of having what they had to sell. And of course, during harvest time, my dad would go out and work for farmers. His wages would, as I was growing up as a kid, he would get $1 a day board and room. Mom would stay at home there, and my brother, who was 6 years older than I was, we did a lot on the farm. And then he would get off from the farm he worked on to do what was necessary around our place. And in the wintertime, when it was cold, we did a lot of cutting of wood, cutting of rails, and fence posts, and then we would sell those in the spring and summer, and that would bring in some money. And of course, one year, in the fall of the year, what we might have had to sell, like, was a bit of wheat and perhaps potatoes and other things that we could sell and get money out of. And of course, as we were raising a certain amount of cattle, we would sell off the ones that were.
Tell me about a visit from the Watkins products man.
Yes, we'd have the Watkins man that came to our home, and I still remember his last name. It was Peck, Lewis Peck. And he was a fascinating man. He only had one leg.
Did he arrive with a horse and a buggy?
And he would arrive with a horse and a buggy, yes. And he'd always stay overnight. And
with
of course.
You? With you?
Yeah, yes, it just seemed like that was kind of a convenient place. Uh-huh. And we so enjoyed him because he was a rather portly man and perhaps seemed awfully old in those days. He probably was up to nearly 40.
Dressed how?
Dressed nice. Dressed
a
nice.
Suit?
Somewhat, I think so.
White shirt, tie?
Perhaps. I
hat.
Can't remember. And a hat. Oh, yes, definitely a hat.
Did he look like a big city feller?
Never thought of that. Oh, yeah. I think he lived in Cole.
Oh.
So it wasn't an awful long way.
Right.
But when he'd go to bed at night, of course, we only had two bedrooms, so he would sleep with my brother or I, or sometimes both of us. He'd take that great big old wooden leg off. And that was so fascinating to us. But we waited for him, and of course, all of our different things that we had, that spices and whatever, you know, pretty important to buy.
Now, did he come with two or three big suitcases?
Yes, he did. And they were pretty heavy for him to handle. But yes, he'd bring them in.
And would he lay them out on the floor?
And lay them out on the table and floor. And
you'd pick them over or what? Or did
my
you
mother,
just point say?
My mother did all of that buying.
You boys weren't allowed to touch?
No, really not.
Okay.
But I have to tell you this one thing, which is funny, because a very, very dear man, my granddad Sanderson's younger brother, name was Harry. Everybody loved my Uncle Harry. And he was just so well liked, but he didn't do very good in business. He tried businesses two or three times. But those days there was prohibition. And of course, Uncle Harry, being a good Scotchman, he indulged as much as he could and whenever he could. And it would always make my mother furious because after the Watkins man had been there a little while, Uncle Harry would come. The vanilla extract would disappear.
There's no vanilla like that.
But he enjoyed getting into the vanilla.
It does say alcohol, 8.25%. That gives it a kick.
Yeah, it's all right beer.
Very good. I want to take a picture of that.
But the Raleigh man.
You called him the Wally man?
Raleigh.
Raleigh was another.
Raleigh products.
Uh-huh.
Similar to the Watkins products?
Similar.
Yes. And again, it was typical to watch for the Raleigh man, but Watkins was the most prominent of the two.
How often would these men come?
I would say probably twice a year?
Probably. I can't remember that part.
I can't either.
Would they come when it was snowy?
No.
This was strictly fair weather selling?
I would think so. I can't remember winter time. So much of that would freeze, wouldn't it?
And I suppose they wanted cash for any sale.
That I can't remember.
I can't either. Of course, they would pay so much to stay overnight, which is probably 20, 25 cents perhaps. And that would go toward buying something.
Do you have the impression that your mother was buying much? Maybe more than two or three items at a time?
Oh, yes.
Really?
Yes, I would think 12 or 15 things. Because... Yeah.
Did it range mostly in the vanilla and the food line, or did she buy brushes and washcloths and other sorts of things like that?
Deborah got those from the Fuller Brush Man.
We never did have a Fuller Brush when I was a kid. I don't know. There were other things, such as you suggested, that that reminds me, but I'm not at all sure on that.
But you implied earlier that there were several things that the Watkins man bought that you would like to have yourself.
Not as a child for me.
I see.
Sears Roebuck and Montgomery Ward, you bet.
Okay. Elma, did you shop from the Sears Roebuck or Montgomery Ward catalog, or wish you could?
Yeah. I have another story on the Watkins. I worked for a lady one summer for my room and board, and Watkins had a red liniment that they put out in the same type of bottle as their vanilla. We were cooking for Hayman, and she baked a pie, and she put in the vanilla into this pie, and I looked at it, and it wasn't quite the right color. And I tasted it, and she had grabbed the red liniment bottle instead of the vanilla bottle. So we just dipped it out and stirred it up and put the vanilla in it, and it was fine.
Ate the liniment anyway. Anybody remark about that?
No. They were too busy.
A new flavor treat.
Yeah.
The liniment probably had a fair amount of alcohol in it, too. Yeah,
probably did.
Well, how about catalogs? Did you make use of catalogs?
Not an awful lot.
Did you spend some time leafing through, wishing?
Just to sit and look at them. I passed away the time as a kid.
What kinds of items especially attracted your attention?
Oh, probably clothing, which I didn't have too much of in those days. My mother worked for a dollar a day and kept two kids on it, so we didn't have a lot to, a lot more wishing than a lot more than buying.
Did that wishing ever become so strong that you really felt as though you wanted to be able to change your situation so you could have more of those things?
No, because we didn't have them. We didn't know what they would be like without it, or to have them, so...
You think that's really true?
Yeah, I do. I don't. Just enough clothes to go to school and maybe a new dress or new pair of shoes on Easter was all I ever cared about.
In other words, at that time, there really wasn't much of a consuming urge.
There really
wasn't. We certainly have it now.
Oh, I know. Times have changed.
Yes. Is there any other way you can account for the fact that that wishing didn't become a strong urge?
No, other than I just probably knew we couldn't have it and didn't worry about it.
Okay. That's just the way it is, and there's no point in thinking about changing it?
No, because just a kid, and poor old mom had quite a time putting clothes on her back and food in her mouth.
So it didn't bother you too much if your shoes were worn or your dress had holes in it?
They never did, but I don't think it would have.
Oh. She saw that everything was repaired at least. Huh?
Yeah. I might say some more about Somerville and the buildings.
All right.
They at one time had a big livery stable. They had a hotel. They had a bank, a brewery. The brewery and the bank were not operating at the time that I lived there, or the hotel. It was lived in by the people that had owned it, some elderly men.
Has it been a beer brewery?
It was a, yeah, it was a beer brewery, And there was a large hall that was, I guess the Masons had built it. There was quite an active Masonic lodge there at that time. And every Memorial Day, all of the women in the valley and all over would bring food, and they would have this big Memorial Day dinner, and people, they would be standing in line clear around that hall, wait to eat anything you wanted. It was a wonderful dinner. I don't even remember how much they charged for it, but I know I was just felt real privileged to be able to wait on the tables and to serve ice cream and all. And there's been so many people that have that knew about it. Of course, most of them are gone now, but have remarked about what a wonderful dinner that was and a wonderful way to spend Memorial Day. And that money that they made on that went to the cemetery. They took care of the cemetery that way.
What was usually on the menu?
Oh, golly. Fried chicken, ham, beef, turkey, pies of all kinds, cakes. It was just all contributed.
One big potluck.
Oh, monstrous, yeah. The table was probably as long here, full length of this house.
And were you involved in preparing food?
Well, no, I was too young to do that. Mm-hmm.
But you could eat it.
Oh, you bet.
So was that an all-day affair?
Well, as long as anybody would come, yeah.
Starting at 11 o'clock in the morning, maybe, going until 5
yeah,
or 6?
Yeah, probably about that. Mm-hmm.
Any entertainment?
No entertainment.
No band?
Mm-mm.
Singing?
No band, no screaming, no hollering.
Mm-hmm. How did people dress for that? Any different from the ordinary day?
Just, of course, they didn't wear, everybody didn't wear jeans, old holy jeans then, like they do now, but mostly dresses. And
clean jeans, maybe. Like,
huh?
Clean jeans.
Yeah, and clean jeans.
Mm-hmm.
Patched jeans.
Yes. And that was a tradition that had gone on perhaps as long as Somerville had existed?
That was a yearly thing.
Mm-hmm.
1 year to the next.
Do you think maybe 200 or 300 people would come?
Oh, I'm sure. 500, wouldn't you?
For what?
The Memorial Day dinners at Somerville.
Must have been. The whole valley, including many people from LeGrand, would come.
Did you go?
Oh, yes, we participated, both of us.
Well, she said she was pretty young.
Yeah, but that was fun to do. I mean, you were big stuff when you got to help do that.
when my brother and another boy, when he was old enough, they would carry coffee from another house where the group of people were just making the coffee. And we'd bring the coffee in a big pot from where it was being made to the hall. And water, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I got to be old enough, and you made 50 cents to do that. And 50 cents was a lot of money in those days.
Surely the men brought their own liquor.
No,
there was no liquor. I don't think there was any liquor.
The only thing that might have been was like your uncle and another guy or two who was moonshiners would perhaps have something out in the car, but never really speaking.
My uncle of mine was a moonshiner.
Uncle Press.
Oh.
And Mike.
Well, now that we're on that, tell me about the moonshine manufacturer.
there were moonshine people.
We made beer. I know we made beer.
Yeah, we'd make beer and wine.
Did you see those operations up close?
Of the both of them?
Yeah.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
Would they do it out in the shed somewhere?
No, that'd be done right in the house. Yeah. But things like whiskey, that was moonshine. That was done out somewhere where they didn't want to be caught at it, you know. But as far as making, in some cases.
Well, beer at that time, they didn't want to get caught at either. Dad made beer. And I'd go get a cup of it, and he'd give me a cup of it, and I'd take a sip and go out behind the house and pour it out. Go back for another one.
What did you want him to think?
I don't know if he thought I was drinking it or not.
What did you want him to think?
I don't know.
You could hold your liquor. There must have been a newspaper in Somerville at that time, or around that time, wasn't there?
I don't remember.
I don't remember either.
Did you read any newspaper?
We had the Observer later in life. Mm-hmm. I can't remember when we first started getting it. I think I was probably in high school because we couldn't afford it.
Well, I was asking that partly to find out whether reading was a part of each of your young lives.
I don't remember reading the newspaper.
In my case, I read everything that we had, sometimes two or three times. We had probably 15, 20 books. That were very precious to us. They were.
Do you remember what some of them were?
God Made the World. There was one that had to do with World War I. Pictures and episodes of the World War I. We had Ben-Hur. St. Elmo. The Little Shepherd of Kingdom Come. These are just some that come to my mind right now. But
no books that were specifically for children or young people?
Yes, yes there were.
I couldn't be bothered to sit still long enough to read books. I had other things to do. Like I don't know what.
But
was music part of your young lives?
Can I talk first? Indirectly, mine was in that the Hug family that you have or will learn a lot about because they were the background of the early pioneers of Elgin beginning. And these people were Swiss and they were quite talented as people. My grandfather, Niederer, was a great yodeler. And I don't remember my grandmother being so much, but I had an aunt, Tilly. She was Lydia M. Hug. She was an educator. She never married. But she had many talents. And so when I was in high school, I traded a horse for a saxophone. And I never did read music worth a hoot, but...
Was that a good bargain?
I think so.
Which was worth more at the time?
Well, I did get another horse later. But I learned to play that, and it gave me a lot of satisfaction. And my brother bought that from me, so I got my money back.
Did you teach yourself to play it?
By ear, uh-huh. Yeah, by ear. And he then got it, and he played in a little orchestra that played weekends at the dances, like at Somerville or Pleasant Grove, and he was...
Would you like a cup of coffee?
Just water.
Or something to drink?
Water.
Just water. Mm-hmm.
let's move up to Dry Creek School then. Is that the first school you went to?
My first school was when we made our trip to Vancouver Island, to north of Victoria, a place called Sydney, when we found out that we were financially in bad trouble, we moved back to Vancouver, Washington, and that was my first school. And I went there for probably 3 or 4 months, maybe 5, and my mom and dad got into another venture that went sour quick. We bought an upstairs apartment. What we bought was just the furnishings because we were paying rent for the rest of it, and it turned out that after we bought it that the people that had it knew that the place was going to be condemned because the boiler was bad. So from there we moved back to what is called Paloma, which is just outside of Portland on the Columbia River, and went to work. My mom cooked, and my brother and dad milked cows on a dairy. And that was the last part of my first year of school. And right after that, we got a letter from home, and the man who was, he and his family were renting our farm. He got blood poisoning from a splinter in his finger and died. And so we had to go back to take over the farm again. And so my second grade was back at Dry Creek School, the one-room school that so much to get read
about. I think from the article in the Observer I read that it was built about 1885.
It's all recorded in this book here, when it was built and what went into it. So
the school was probably 30 or 40 years old at least when you got there.
Yes. My dad went through 4 years of school at the creek, at there. He would only go in the wintertime when it was too stormy to work. So he was probably went to 5 or 6 years of school there, but finally made it somewhere into the fourth grade. My mother went all 8 years to the school. And of course my brother went all, well, intermittently when he was not at Vancouver and
Sydney.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah.
Or Paloma.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
So the first year that we got back, the teacher that taught our class lived at our home with us. And so my brother, he drove a buggy with a horse to the school, and he transported this teacher and I to school.
What time did she need to get there?
She needed to get there about, I never really thought about time, but school took up at 9 o'clock. So we had to be there early enough to get the big fire started in the heater in the one-room school, and to...
It's a fairly large room.
It was all one big room, yes. The outhouses were outside, mm-hmm. and the wood was in an ante room. Huh? It was just one big school, big mm-hmm. room.
Mm-hmm. I've been in it. I can visualize it.
The old red schoolhouse?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I took some pictures of it. But you had to get there early enough so she had time to make a fire and get lessons ready, it's, I suppose.
You're right, and she did.
So you kind of had an inside view of what a teacher's life is like, didn't you? If she was living with you.
I would have been in the either second or third grade at that time.
So you and didn't really
realize? I don't have a memory about that. I don't remember her living at our home. I can just remember from pictures where she would ride to school.
Do you remember what she looked like?
She was awfully, awfully impressive. Is about all I can remember. She dressed nice. And
a stocky lady?
Somewhat.
Uh-huh.
Somewhat. Uh-huh. Pretty. Face.
What sort of a temperament?
I don't remember that.
Well, do you remember her talking in a loud, angry voice?
I actually today don't. I would be guessing.
I think if she did, you would remember that.
I can remember the next 2 years of school real well. I would have been in the third grade then, I think.
I can remember my kindergarten teacher better than almost any other teacher.
You can.
So I thought you might remember your second grade teacher.
Well, I can remember a first grade teacher that I had at Columbia School, and things that she did and put us through. And I can remember a couple of songs that she taught us, and I can still remember them all this day.
Well, tell me something about the routine at Dry Creek.
Well, the following year, there was a local lady by the name of Fern McGinnis. She was born and raised right near the school, and her dad was so proud. His name was Clem McGinnis, and he had a thrashing machine. And just before he opened school that year, he showed us what he had made out of belt straps, big wide belt straps off of the machine that powered the
mill.
The thrashing machine. And he had told us, boy, those kids are going to be good, because if she doesn't, here's what I made for her to use. So the kids came to school that fall, and there was some pretty ornery kids at that time. And so she whacked a few of them with these big belts. So all the kids did, they put on three or four pairs of breeches, of overalls. And they'd yell and holler, and she'd whip one and then another, and somebody got to laugh and they'd whip him. Really, this is true. And these kids would just make a big farce out of it. She'd whip them until she got tired. I may be exaggerating a little, but not much. The next year, we had another teacher come in. Her name was Pet Elmer. I think Pet was her nickname, but Pet Elmer. She was a raw-boned lady, probably 5'7", and kind of a stern look. And some of these smart kids that had been so ornery before, if they had two or three pairs of overalls, she'd strip them down to the one. And she had a little belt like that, and they got about one licking, and that was it. I can remember one of the kids' dads brought this kid up, because my dad was there on the school board that year, and showed him what had happened. My dad said, well, he probably needed it. But not many kids got lickings. And most everybody said that was one of the best years we ever had, as far as she's a good teacher and we learned well and there was no nonsense went on.
What would you say, this is through a child's view, of course, made you think that a teacher was good at what she did?
That was my first impression, was at the end of that year. We all respected her. She was firm, but she was very fair. And of course, we learned a lot just from listening to the parents talking to other parents, you know. She was a well-respected woman.
I wondered whether there was anything about the way she presented the lessons that somehow made learning more effective.
I don't really know, Eugene. It'd be second-handed by thinking back in retrospect.
From what I know about teaching methods,
and I've been a teacher for many years, so I've thought about this a lot. In a school like that, it would have been a lot of rote learning, memorizing the multiplication tables, doing X number of problems, memorizing spellings, memorizing lists of prepositions, memorizing the capitals of states and so on. Am I correct about that?
We had all of that. You bet we did.
This is rote learning.
And Palmer method.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Now you can't read what the kids write.
Yes. Certainly one can't say that rote learning is a bad way of teaching or learning. However, it has severe limitations. And so I wondered whether the teachers you thought were really good maybe went beyond rote learning a little bit. For instance, in having discussions about subjects, possibly controversial subjects, to make you think more deeply. Did any of them do that?
Well, I don't think we were old enough to really pay too much attention to that, or it wasn't as important then as it is now. That I can remember.
Eugene, as I think back and think of answering your question, probably Penny Elmer, without us even realizing this, did some of this. I was having too much fun playing as a kid growing up, and my last 3 years in grade school were kind of easy. In fact, my eighth grade teacher was only 17 years old. And when it come to taking my county examination to pass the eighth grade, she sat with me.